Linoleum knife. Jellyfish linoleum knife.
Yes.
That was jellyfish.
It sure was.
On a brand new cassette that was gifted to Alonzo yesterday. A brand new 23-year-old cassette.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Margie.
Yes.
And
one of my favorite bands ever.
When she gave it to me, she said, "What's this band sound like?" I said, "I can't really describe this band. They sound like the Bugaloos." And I'm like, I don't know if there's any way really to say how they sound.
They sound like the best parts of the 60s and 70s put in a blender. I don't know.
I guess. Yeah. Anyway, that's them.
Yeah.
One of your favorite bands.
Who made two albums.
Now, they did exactly what a band is supposed to do.
They made two albums and then broke up.
They made two albums and they broke up. That's what a band should do. Unless they're, you know, one of my favorite bands, then they should stay together forever.
I see.
Putting out decreasingly relevant material but satisfying me immensely.
And then breaking off in like the solo act, doing, you know, duets with Yusuf Endur or something.
And then getting divorced.
Yes. You're still upset about that, aren't you?
For the rest of my life. This is not a wound that's going to heal.
The Kim and Thurston divorce.
That's not ever going to go away from me. My own parents' divorce.
I was
going to
say, you're
makes me less unhappy.
You're a child of actual divorce. Perhaps you should explain what this program is.
The show is called Linoleum Knife. It's a podcast about movies with you, Alonzo Duralde, and me, Dave White. Alonzo Duralde is the film critic of movies.com. No.
No.
I'm the film critic of movies.com. Yes. I'm Dave White.
Yes.
You're the film critic of therap.com.
And What the Flick.
And What the Flick. Also,
I'm glad we established that.
You are a real G who moves silent like lasagna.
That's a pretty great lyric.
It came back to me yesterday on the internet, and I thought, that's... How else am I to describe you?
Well, you know,
when other than my current lover.
Mm-hmm. Well, I describe you to quote, you know, it's always fair weather.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
A man who's Clifton Webb and Marlon Brando that's combined.
Right. I didn't know that song. It was from a song. I just thought you would, you know,
coined that. No,
coined it, and I was very, you know, I felt very happy when you said that. Okay, so we don't have a lot of movies to talk about.
No, I do want to. I want to wish happy birthday to
three. We have three.
Yes, I want to wish happy birthday to Korean superstar Chil Kong, whose letter we're going to read this week.
Are we
going to
do it right now? Before
we don't have to do it right now.
We can do
it
later.
We have to do
it
on this episode.
We're doing it today.
Okay,
because I promise it's on my list. It's right here. I cut and pasted it.
Okay,
I copied and pasted it into my document that I now. This is my new streamlined efficiency model of not...
Except for the times that you cut and paste it without putting the people's name on it.
Right. And then, but this, everything's in, or I have every duck in a row.
Nice.
Today.
Okay.
All of them are rowed up. They're in the duck line. So, Lindsay Lohan, she's at Coachella this weekend.
Is she?
She's really super enjoying herself, too.
That's great.
Yeah.
She needs more fun in her life. After all that hard work.
I think she was waiting for My Bloody Valentine to take the stage right now.
Really?
But I don't think My Bloody Valentine is there this week.
No.
I don't think she knows who My Bloody Valentine is.
Probably not. I'm thinking no.
But what I would really love is for them to be at Coachella.
Uh-huh.
And for her to be in the front.
Oh, God.
When they do the Holocaust portion of You Made Me Realize for 30 minutes, that's what I want.
Something that made even...
I want her to experience that.
Something that made even you exit the venue.
Run from the building.
And if you can't handle it, I don't know who I don't know who's left as their audience.
It's not that I... Okay, well, no, I can't handle it. I used to...
Physically.
Back in the day, when I was a kid, I could handle it.
Yes.
But I didn't understand what it was doing to me.
And all that handling is why you're half deaf.
It's why I can't hear a thing anymore.
Yeah.
But
Like, if the water's running, you cannot have a conversation with Dave White.
When, as in the early 90s, I got the point. Mm-hmm. Like, I was in my mid-20s, and I went to see Jawbox. I don't know if that's a band you even know about.
I know the name, but...
I went to see Jawbox, and I was like, oh, man, I really do need earplugs from now on. Like, Black Flag is officially the band that did this to me.
That destroyed your upper register?
Yeah. That's not a generic sort of, oh, a band like Black Flag. No.
Actual Black
Flag. It was actual Black Flag actually destroying my ears for about 3 days in a row. And then, I didn't learn from that experience because I was... barely out of my teenage years when
one's telling you anything.
I might have been 20, yeah. Mid 20s, I went to see Jawbox and I was like, I think I need to start wearing earplugs to shows. And I started wearing earplugs and I went to see Unsane. And
see, that's the kind
and
of
I had to leave.
That's the kind of band that James Rocky would jokingly say that you would go to see, but you actually went to see.
I went to see all the bands.
I see.
All the good ones.
Oh
yeah. And I had to leave that show because even with earplugs, it was too loud.
Hmm.
And then when we went to the My Bloody Valentine show a couple years ago at the me and Aaron and Chris. It's understood that it's not you.
Well, I just want to be clear.
You are never with me.
I want to be clear on this for people just tuning in.
When I went to My Bloody Valentine, they did the Holocaust. Now, anybody who doesn't understand what this is, there's a song called You Made Me Realize that they close their shows with. And anywhere between 5 and 45 minutes of this final song is...
A sonic assault?
Like standing next to an airplane as it's revving to take off.
Hmm.
That loud and that brutal and that difficult, and that much noise, like an impenetrable amount of noise. And Aaron, of course, you know, he
stuck it out.
He's Iron Man. Yeah, he stayed through the whole thing. But after about 3 minutes, I guess, I had the earplugs, but I was like, I can't do this. I went out onto the lawn of the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And
you could hear it perfectly from there, I'm sure.
Perfectly, yeah. Even from there, yeah.
You need those. What was it that Gwyneth Paltrow would put on her baby when they would go to radio to Coldplay shows? Like
those big noise canceling headphones.
Yeah.
Like the kind that the air traffic people on the ground wear.
Right.
Yeah, well, I saw the Boredoms here in Los Angeles a few years back, and Yoshimi, their little Boredoms baby, had their baby and with her, and the kid, the whole, from start to finish, the kid had this kid's like 2 or 3 at the time,
right,
had the noise-canceling headphones on. Because, so, I mean, when your parents are the Boredoms, that's, you'd better, basically anyone who is an adult with a child who is, and the adult is in a band,
mm-hmm.
you better invest in some those for your kids.
I remember
you're a horrible parent.
I remember the days when you know, people in bands left their kids at home, you know, with the nanny in the back of the hotel. Well, you got to bring the kid to the show?
Because you don't want that kid to grow up to be on drugs. You want that kid to be with you. You want to parent
you
that
want
kid.
That kid to grow up and make movies like Duncan Jones and Sofia Coppola about people trapped in lavish enclosures.
Right. Okay, now those are two. Those are two children of celebrities who've grown up and done something valuable with their life.
And turned their precious cloistering into art.
The rest of them
are on drugs.
Are freebasing cocaine. And so, you know, take your kids with you on tour.
Uh-huh.
Protect them. Expose them to awesome, you know, artists. Give them a pair of noise-canceling headphones.
I see.
Yeah. I don't think that's a bad problem. I don't think it's a bad idea. Leave that kid home with the nanny.
Take him on tour, but you have to bring him to the show, is what I'm saying.
Oh, well, you know, I don't know.
I think there's only so much noise canceling you can do to little baby tympanic eardrums when you're just blaring this.
I don't know.
You know.
I don't know the answer to that.
We'll find out. Okay, fine. So instead of being on drugs, they'll just be deaf adults. And, you know,
that'll right.
Be.
We started this talking about Lindsay Lohan.
Oh, right.
We have a reason. because she's also in a, she's celebrating a film release this weekend. And in this film, she looks completely dead inside.
Yes.
There is not an emotion that crosses her face.
Yeah, it's not even just that, like, whatever is happening with her face and the all-too-human flesh, her eyes are dead.
The all-too-human flesh is being worked on in a way that a 20-year-old, a woman in her 20s, should not be doing.
Correct.
To herself. But she's doing it. It's clear. It's clear from looking at her that she's doing horrible things to her face, cosmetically, with procedures. Mm-hmm. And she's in her 20s.
Yes.
And but also the eyes, there's nothing. And there's nothing happening.
I take no pleasure in dumping on Lindsay Lohan because I was a huge
fan. I take pleasure in making fun of her.
I was a huge fan of hers.
I don't know that I want to dump on her.
I know, but I know what you mean. But I mean, like, you know, I just thought she was so promising. You know, when you look at you know, Parent Trap and Freaky Friday and Mean Girls, it's like, wow, here's a, you know, like, good comic timing and just like great camera presence and really, you know, charismatic and empathetic and all the things that you want a young actress to be. And it saddens me to see what has become of her life. And I wonder, and you reach a point where you think, is there any way to fix this?
Maybe.
Is she so damaged? Is she so lacking in any kind of support mechanism, given the crazy parents that she has, that she can come back from the precipice?
I think I think it's possible, but I think that career has to bottom out and life has to bottom out. And as long as enablers like Charlie Sheen are out there catching her,
right?
Because he's like her, you know, fairy godmother now. It's
like,
weird.
Like she wasn't doomed enough.
Right. And like he takes care of her in some weird way.
Duh.
Like gives her money and, you know, does things with her and does projects with her. Like he's like, I don't know what his motivation is. Maybe they have some arrangement worked out.
Maybe he's a kindred spirit.
But it's, you know, I don't think he's helping her. And this movie that we saw isn't helping either one of them.
No.
Like the A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III is a better use of Charlie Sheen's time.
Right. And
than
and
what this is.
And a more amusing exploration of Charlie Sheen's Charlie Sheen-ness.
Right. Yeah.
Although, granted, they have a scene in this film. Like, they basically have the pre-credits sequence, and then that's it. They're gone.
Right. It's not a movie that they're carrying.
No.
But they sure do their best to sink it in the first few minutes. Because
they let you know you're in trouble.
Well, what they let you know is that the entire movie is going to be as awful as their scene.
Exactly.
And it's an absolute disaster.
You know, it's funny. I mean,
we're talking about Scary Movie.
I remember back when Mel Brooks's High Anxiety opened in the late 70s. Pauline Kael or somebody said the problem with this movie is that whereas Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein felt like, you know, sort of affectionate send-ups of those genres, this movie, what it does with Hitchcock is basically lets you know that Mel Brooks has also seen those movies.
Right.
And, you know, you can take or leave that argument as it applies to High Anxiety, but so many of these movies with the word movie in the title,
right,
they don't create jokes. They just let you know that they also saw Mama and Black Swan and whatever.
It's kind of predicated on the Dane Cook kind of comedy where it's sort of like, hey, Rock'em Sock'em Robots, who remembers that? You know, and
but then you don't go that next step and
comment
upon them, right?
No. And so now that this is its own little micro-genre, the parody film that sort of throws, you know, 8 or 9 different movies together in a ball and and goes, remember we had this thing in Inception, and here's a guy that looks like Leonardo DiCaprio to remind you about this thing in the Inception, and then here comes a lady with a poop pie, and she's, remember the help, everybody? You know, it's not anything. It's not anything that anyone needs or wants. The people, we had to go see it Friday morning because they didn't show it to the press. And we went on, we went to the Century City Mall. Mm. And there were about eight or nine people in the theater. Five of us were film critics.
Yes.
Because we all sat together.
Right.
The other four, one of them was one of those people who goes in and makes note of the trailers.
To make sure they're showing the right ones.
The people whose job it is to make sure the trailers are being shown properly.
And almost every trailer we saw had a number in the title, which was a little depressing.
The other two people were a couple who, as we left finally, when it was over, mm-hmm. they were on the escalator behind us.
Right.
And the guy, I overheard the guy say, it had its moments.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, it didn't.
It had roughly three moments.
Remind me what those were.
Okay.
Because I've already forgotten.
And almost, and nothing that I remember from this movie had anything to do with any of the human beings in this film. Although there were I want to say there were some times that Ashley Tisdale made me kind of go, ha, but I can't remember what they are. The only things I remember laughing at is a scene where a bunch of wet vacs have a party. That's wet vac with a V as in Victor, like vacuum cleaners.
The pool cleaning vac.
It was a bunch of vacuum cleaners having a crazy party.
That was okay.
And the scene where, most of the scene is not funny. They're when they're doing Black Swan, they're parodying the scene where the hot lesbian makeout scene. So what they do, because it's a PG-13 movie, they cut to like two pairs of scissors clanging at each other, and then two tacos bumping at each other, and then two hot dog buns rubbing up at each other. So again, none of that was funny. But then the last thing they show is a plastic like toy train tunnel, and you think you're going to get the train going through it as the sexual metaphor, and instead another plastic train tunnel comes crashing into it. That was funny.
I did laugh at the two tunnels.
And that's it. That's all I remember for this movie. Plastic train tunnels and partying vacuum cleaners. That's it. And the sad part of all this is that the script is credited to David Zucker, who is one of, ZAZ, the guys who gave us, Airplane and Top Secret and Ruthless People, and Pat Proft, who is... he was one of the credited screenwriters of Real Genius People. This is a guy who's been around for ages, has like tons and tons and tons and tons of comedy credits from Police Squad to, you name it. And this movie's so not funny. It's like all it has to be is funny. It doesn't have to have a plot. It doesn't have to have, characters that do anything but support a gag. Not funny.
Nothing.
That's all we wanted you to be, Scary Movie 5, was funny, and you're not. And clearly, they must have finished this thing like
5 days ago.
Yeah, because they make jokes about the Evil Dead remake.
I was talking to another film critic about this, how they accomplished filming a parody of a movie that came out 7 days ago.
Well, it did screen at South by Southwest, so they might have seen it in March,
Perhaps. Or perhaps they got
an early look.
An early look, or a script, or some sort of, deal made, hey,
we want to include you, let us see
you.
It,
Basically, it's product placement.
It's like when Mad Magazine used to get to see movies early so that their parody would run on time.
Which I'm sure, something was worked out.
Yeah,
obviously, but it feels weird.
Yeah,
it feels weird that the entirety of the plot is pretty much based on Mama.
Yeah, which came out 3 months.
Which came out 3 months ago. But that same thing. I'm sure they saw it earlier. They had a script or whatever. So, yeah. It makes me tired to think about it.
Yeah, it's kind of weirdly racist and misogynist at points, and it's just...
I think A Haunted House might be a better movie than this.
It's neck and neck.
It's Haunted House... threw up into the mouth of the Scary Movie franchise, and then the Scary Movie franchise diarrhea'd all of that out.
Thank you for that image.
Back into the mouth of a haunted house. And then it just did that back, like forever. Like a circle of puking and diarrhea. Okay,
ink. Thank you. Stop. Stop now.
I didn't,
stop it.
Look, it's a clean podcast. It's not a. I didn't say it's not a not gross podcast.
if you were to ask me a month from now, like if you were to show me the scene with the phony psychic from A Haunted House and the phony psychic from Scary Movie 5, like I would probably not be able to tell you which was which.
Weren't they both Cat Williams?
Were they? Maybe. I don't even know. It's like it's the same joke, it feels like, and it was not funny either
time. I don't remember. I think maybe Cat Williams was in both films.
He might, yeah. How proud he must have been. That's what Scary Movie 5 needed. It was more Nick Swardson.
He's just getting paid, you know.
God.
And it was halfway through it, you were saying, how did they get these people to be in this movie? I said, well, you know, they give them money.
But it's like, okay, I get why Simon Rex and Ashley Tisdale will be in this movie, because what other offers are they getting? But, you know, Sarah Hyland and Katrina Bowden and stuff, it's like, I don't know, it felt like there were people who were too classy to be in this flick.
There's no such thing.
Even for a day.
There's no such thing as too classy.
You know, Usher's in this movie.
There's no such thing as too classy. No, Usher is not in this movie.
Isn't he?
Oh, my God.
What movie did I just see Usher in?
You're so racist. That was Bow Wow.
No. There's another movie with Usher where he's the... Is Bow Wow the janitor who dances?
You don't know your young black musicians well enough to know. You're that guy that goes up to someone and goes, oh, hey, you're Kanye West. And he's like, no, I'm Ludacris. You know, like, that's you. Spaniards. Spaniards are racist.
Stop it. I'm not racist. I just thought it was Usher.
It was Bow Wow.
All right, whatever, fine. That's like that Sarah Silverman joke.
Yes. The one I just said.
You just told, yes, yeah. But badly.
Okay. That's why I'm not Sarah Silverman.
Yeah. So, yeah, Scary Movie 5, there's nothing else to say.
There really is not. So let's continue on.
Yes.
To 42. Are you allowed to talk about 42 now that you're racist?
Oh, shut up. 42 ended racism, so we're all good now. No, I'm kidding. I really liked 42, and yeah, you know,
well, I knew I was gonna like 42.
Yeah, I mean, I always had to explain to like the what the flick people are all into sports.
Yeah, so
like Christy made this really obscure joke about what 42 was about that they had to be explained to me, and well, it's like
what was the joke?
That it was about some player, or like apparently there's one player in the major leagues who still wears 42. Because he was wearing
it. How was that possible?
Because he was wearing it before they retired it. And so he says he was going to wear it for the rest of his career in honor of Jackie Robinson.
I thought they retired it.
They retired it, but apparently if you currently
have... When did they get around to retiring that number?
I don't know, but there's some sort of grandfather clause involved, basically, where if you're still wearing that number when they retire it, you can wear it until you retire. So there's one guy left who's still wearing this number.
I'm confused. They would have had.
You're asking me. I don't know.
They would have had to have retired that number like 10 years ago or something. Is that how long they waited to retire that number?
It may well be. I don't know.
They just willy nilly let some other dude wear 42.
Ask Christy Lanier.
I'm gonna.
She can explain this to you. My point was, I don't know or care about sports, but I like sports movies.
Yeah, well, I'm same. I'm not super interested in sports. I mean, I know because they are in the culture. I know things,
right? But like, how many baseball games do you have to sit through to get the moments of excitement that happen in this film? You know,
who was it when we were at Thanksgiving at your family's house in Atlanta? There was a commercial with a famous athlete on it, and you didn't know who, and I'm blanking which athlete this was.
Yeah.
And you didn't know who it was. I was like, that's blah, blah, blah. And I want to say it was like Kobe.
No, it wasn't Kobe, but it was somebody like that. It was some big like basketball guy.
And
I had no idea.
And you and I wish I could remember who was in this commercial now, because it blew my mind that just walking around in life, you didn't know this person's
I thought he was Usher.
Apparently.
No, I didn't know who the guy was.
I think everyone's Usher now.
Everyone, they're all Usher. The president is Usher. I don't know.
You're completely racist.
I am not. Look, I would just as easily confuse two, like, young white stars whose careers I wasn't
like all three of those guys in The Host?
For instance, yes.
We will never be able to tell those three guys in The Host apart.
Look, if you, you know...
They had better go off in three radically different career directions, or else they will never be not told
apart. I will say this in my defense. If you were to...
They will never be told apart.
If you showed me a bunch of random faces and I had to tell you which ones were in One Direction and which ones were in, like, Big Time Rush... Forget it.
No, right. No, I know.
Did you see that SNL sketch? That it was Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney?
Yes. 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 Same thing.
Yes.
All right, so 42.
42. It's the Jackie Sports. Robinson. The Jackie Robinson biopic.
Now, did you know who Jackie Robinson
was? I did know who Jackie Robinson was, yes. Thank you. Because I don't know about sports, as I don't know about my cultural history, you know.
I wanted to ask Bibbs that before. He's just like you.
Oh, yeah.
He hates sports. Like, has a t-shirt that says, I'm going to get this wrong.
Like, your favorite team sucks?
No, the t-shirt says something like, totally not into sports.
Oh, right, but it's in like a font that makes it look like it is a sports shirt.
Yeah. And I've seen it. I've actually watched people get offended by that shirt.
Well, you know, I have that shirt for, you know, the singer-songwriter Blue.
And it's the Red Sox.
It's the Red Sox logo, but it's a pair of red, like, sneakers. Yes. And with his name in the font.
Yeah.
And people start talking to me about the Red Sox. I'm like, no, this isn't that.
Yeah.
I don't know anything. I can't help you.
This movie is based on a true story.
Yes.
Now... That is maybe the one thing about the film that confuses me.
Yeah, it's one thing when you get a horror movie that tells you, you know, inspired by true events.
By a real haunted house.
This is an actual biopic about an actual historical event.
And not an obscure one either.
Yeah, like, and it's still based on a true story.
One of the most famous people of the 20th century, of whom many historical facts are
known.
Available.
Yes.
And so they have chosen to say it is based on a true story. Not good enough anymore. 100% factual information. Real life isn't cinematic enough.
Apparently not. Well, it never was, really.
Yeah, I don't know. But, and the reason that they have to say this is because every single word of this movie is written to be scored with trumpets and violins.
Yeah. Mark Isham, my joke afterwards was, I suppose it's hard to score a baseball movie and not make it sound like The Natural, but he's not even trying. Like, he just did not try to think, like, what's a new way that I can do this? Nope. I'm going to go with exactly what you expect a triumphant baseball movie is going to sound like.
You know? And I was happy about that. I was actually, a film like this, I'm very, very... into on its own terms, because the cheesiest inspirational sports movie in the world, I'm into it.
I'm generally a sucker for that kind of thing.
I'm into it, and this is actually much better than it had to be.
Yeah,
but every word of scripted dialogue in this film is written as though it's someone's Oscar clip. Everyone in the film acts as though they know that they are witnessing history.
Right. Everyone's overcoming something.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to listen to, you know, these sort of like important sentences coming out of everyone's mouth. Even like the little kid who grows up to be a famous baseball player. Spoiler: little kid who grows up to be a famous baseball player himself. And every time they talk, the music swells, or, you know, the sunlight's coming through.
Okay, you're making this sound less entertaining than it is.
No. I'm saying that this is exactly what it is. It's a crazily inspirational sports movie. It's not fully, apparently, historically accurate. In my review for movies.com, I called it power history, which does not care about subtlety or nuance. It cares about this and that and right and wrong and winning and losing, to the point where every person in the movie that has done something bad to Jackie Robinson over the closing crawl,
you find out the rest of their lives were garbage.
Yeah, they were punished. I don't know if they were really punished because it was only based on a true story.
True.
But every person in the movie that did something not nice to Jackie Robinson got their comeuppance.
Now, which brings up an interesting point, because I've seen some critics who have lumped this in with The Help as far as being kind of a phony look back at how racism was and how, you know, there was like the good white people and the bad white people, and not portraying racism as just being omnipresent.
Everywhere, yeah.
And I don't think that's quite fair. I think this movie does, it's not a perfect job. It's still scrubbed, but it's way better than The Help. As far as showing racism as an institutional entity.
A pervasive
thing that was just part of life.
It was with everyone.
Yeah, and not just the bad people and the good people. I mean, there's some of that, and again, this movie is not remotely it is based on a true racism as far as that kind of thing goes. But it's still, it's far more effective than The Help was as far as just showing that it was just a blanketed thing in society.
I understand those critics who are lumping it in with The Help.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does give you white characters. It gives white audiences a white character or two to hook onto.
Right.
As sort of, avatars for your own 21st century.
If I had been there,
I would have been like Harrison Ford.
Right.
If I had been there, I would have been the guy who crosses the street to tell him, I'm with you,
Well, actually, no, Harrison Ford, interestingly, who plays Branch Rickey, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who hires Jackie Robinson in the first place, I mean, eventually, he gets a speech sort of about his home personal history, but the way the film sets him up is, I want to win the World Series.
Mercenary, yeah.
I want to win the World Series, and black players are eventually going to make it out of the Negro Leagues and come play pro ball, so I want to get there first because I want to win the World Series. Mm-hmm. So I liked how pragmatic it was that there was not some crazy altruism behind it. It was like, I want to make money, I want to win this game, I'm going to get this guy who's really good.
Yes.
And I like the fact that a lot of the fellow Dodgers, many of whom are not welcoming and not friendly to Jackie Robinson.
But then you have Pee Wee Reese. We don't really know how Pee-wee Reese.
Sure, no. Granted, but what I was going to say was you have the other Dodgers who were kind of awful to him, and then we see a lot of them turn around not because they've suddenly become better people, but because they see Alan Tudyk's character, the Philadelphia Phillies manager, who is just a horrifying racist,
uses the N-word more than everyone in Django Unchained put together.
Yeah, just like spewing all this hatred, and it's like. And two things happen. One, it's like, ooh, is that what I look like? Is that what I'm thinking?
Yeah.
And two, it's like, hey, this guy's on our team. You can't say that. We can say that, but you can't say that. That kind of family thing. So I like that this movie at least sort of addressed the notion that people don't stop behaving in a racist way necessarily for the greatest of intentions or whatever.
Right. But I mean, again, there is that white character. If we're not gonna include Harrison Ford in this,
Pee-wee Reese, absolutely.
Like you could, as a white audience member, you could say, "Well, I would have been like Pee-wee Reese."
Yes, well, I would have put my arm around him in front of the hometown,
in front of everyone, in front of the whole world. Yeah,
in Cincinnati,
you wouldn't have done that. And so, if you wanted to make a really hard hitting film, it would have been rated R, and it would have shown the brutality, the real brutality of this situation. But they wanted a movie that everybody could go see, and so it had to be a little softer.
Well, it's also you're dealing with something tricky because part of the heroism of Jackie Robinson wasn't just in breaking the color bar and putting himself out there. It was putting himself out there and not responding violently or even like verbally violently when the movie makes it very clear that this is a guy who is capable of real rage. I mean, this is a guy who got court-martialed in the army for not sitting in the back of the bus. So it's not like he is nobody's patsy, but he understands the public relations nature of the position in which he's been placed and has to, you know, behave accordingly. Yeah. And so to make a perceived passivity into a heroic activity is really hard to pull off.
Right.
But I think the movie does that pretty effectively.
And Chadwick Boseman, who plays Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, he's great.
He's great. Like, this, if this movie had come out in December of last year, he would have probably been, he probably would have got an Oscar nomination.
And I hope there's a chance that that happens for him this year.
I think that's, I mean, it's that kind of sort of star-making performance. And so, you know, it's, it has, you know, some reality problems. Better than you thought it was going
to
be.
Much, much better. I also want to give credit to Nicole, is it Beharie? Is that how you say her last name?
Who plays
Rachel Robinson.
Yeah.
Who was, you will remember her if you saw Shame. She is the black woman that goes on the awkward dinner date with Michael Fassbender, and then they have the hotel room rendezvous. Yeah, Nicole Beharie. She takes, you know, let's face it, the role of the wife in a sports biopic is about as thankless as they come. And she makes a really fascinating character. Their chemistry together is great.
Yeah.
They're romantic, they're sexy, they are each other's, you know, rock when they need to be.
Right.
I don't know how much of that is just in the writing and how much of it is what she brings to it, but, you know, the two of them together are fascinating to watch, and I think really get more screen time and more import in the story than you would expect in a movie like this.
I also liked that Wojo from Barney Miller is in it.
Yes, he's so good.
He's 100 now.
There's a lot of great character actors in this movie.
He's in it.
John C. McGinley.
Yeah,
and
who's Chris, he's funny.
He's hilarious as Red Barber. Christopher Maloney. What's his face? Hamish Linklater. I mean, like, it's just a really, T.R. Knight, a really impressive array of character actors in the film.
I really love how Lucas Black
has terrific.
Turned his, what should be an impediment to a career.
What, that he's short?
No, that accent.
Oh, well.
He has turned that somehow into, like, a trademark that he never has to get rid of.
Right.
Like, I don't know if he's capable of sounding anything, like, anything
like
more.
Like, he's not from the Ozarks?
That he's not an utter hick. Mm-hmm. Like, he has the thickest, twangiest, most, like, hillbilly accent of any actor in the United States.
But he's making it work for
him. And he gets to just do it anywhere he goes, like, like, it's, there is, every time he opens his mouth, I'm like, talk more. Say more things.
By the way, I don't know if Malcolm Ingram is still listening to this program, but you need to go see this movie for Christopher Maloney, because he's in his underwear a lot. That is Malcolm's dream man.
Christopher Maloney. Is?
Oh, yeah. He's mentioned on more than one occasion.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah, this is the movie for Malcolm.
Yeah.
Because Maloney is the least clothed person in the movie.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So anyway,
that movie.
I liked it.
Go see it. It's worth
it. I liked it, and it inspired my DVD pick of the week, which I'm just going to tell you right now what it
is. Okay.
I wanted an inspirational sports movie to recommend, and we've already talked about Rudy plenty.
Yeah.
Which you still have
seen. I will see Rudy. Oh, my God. See Rudy. Yay.
Iron Will.
Okay.
Early 90s live-action Disney movie with Mackenzie Astin as a kid who runs the Iditarod.
Brother of Rudy.
Sort of not a sports movie, but sort of a sports movie. Okay. Dog racing, I guess. Is
Kevin Spacey in this?
Something of a sport. Yes, Kevin Spacey's in it. Mackenzie Astin, brother of Rudy. In his own Rudy. I don't know how many people saw this movie, but I used to show it to my students. And here's why. I was not one of those lazy teachers.
You put a movie on.
Just put a movie on. I taught English as a second language, and so I would occasionally use films in units, in unit blocks, mm-hmm. to teach vocabulary. Because the kids would always go to the movies themselves anyway. They would go to see English language movies in town and then come back to school on Monday and tell me what they had seen, mm-hmm. and ask me questions. You know, like, I don't understand this and that. Because they would go see things they didn't even understand.
Huh.
Just
to go to the movies.
To go to the movies and just to hear more English.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because this was middle school, I would give them points each day. Like 2 or 3 points each day for... not being jerks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody does everything they're supposed to do. Everybody, you know, acts like a human being. People aren't urinating on each other or hitting each over the head with stuff.
5 points for Gryffindor?
3 points. Like, it was a communal,
okay.
super communist kind of thing.
So one guy could blow it for everybody.
So one guy could blow it. For pretty much everybody. So it was up to the group to, like, maintain the
to discipline each other.
The jerks, yeah.
Blanket party once for they private
earned,
final.
Yeah, once they earned, I can't remember now how many points, a lot of points. It was maybe once every quarter, if they had earned enough points.
Mm-hmm.
Moving. And I just picked Iron Will off a video store shelf. Like, because it had been... recommended to me by somebody.
And it was PG.
It was PG, and it seemed easy, an easy to understand film, even if you didn't get the dialogue.
Uh-huh.
And I was right. It was perfect. The kids loved it. And it was very easy to understand, even if you didn't understand the things that people were saying.
Hmm.
But after 8 years of teaching, I think I've seen Iron Will 30 times, like just because of being in a classroom,
right?
When it was on, you know.
So Patty Duke is the mother of Rudy and Iron Will.
It's a really exciting family film.
Okay.
And really, real kind of harrowing, you know, in that way that, you know, if you're a kid, it sure. feels like the end of the world is at stake.
Yeah.
If Iron Will doesn't get this race run, mm-hmm. and by the end of the movie he's almost completely dead, like he's almost completely broken physically beyond exhaustion and just almost ruined, and you know, there are bad guys who want to, you know, sabotage him and stuff, but then, you know, all the people in the town are like pulling for him and
gonna win this race.
Really, really moving and all really right. exciting.
Okay.
Even if you don't have any kids, super watch this movie. You'll dig it. I mean, I didn't have to watch it with a bunch of 12-year-olds, but, you know, it provided me with a good excuse.
Okay.
It's awesome. And it is available.
Nice.
On DVD.
Good.
Yes.
So the third movie this week you did not see. I did.
I'm going to take a little break.
Okay. new film called Simon Killer. It is the second movie from Antonio Campos, who did a film called After School a few years ago, which is actually my DVD recommendation of the week, but we'll get to that in a moment. Campos is also part of the sort of this kind of filmmaking collective, you might call it. He and a couple of other filmmakers sort of, you know, one of them will direct and the other ones will produce, and they work on each other's scripts. And one of the films that this group of folks have put out was Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. So a lot of the folks involved with that film are in this one, including Brady Corbett, who played one of the cult members in that movie. He is the star, playing a guy named Simon. And he is a recent college graduate who has recently been dumped by his girlfriend or broken up with her, depending on whose story you believe, and is traveling through Europe. And he is in Paris. And he sort of tells a story early on about how, like, his girlfriend cheated on him and he broke up with her and he's all sad about it. But the more we get to know this guy, the more we realize he's bad news.
I walked back and forth. You watched it on a screener, and I walked back and forth, you know, doing stuff around the house. And I knew just from the griminess of this kid that...
yeah.
He was bad news, and we were fixing to learn that he was even more bad news.
Right.
Yeah.
Plus, the movie's called Simon Killer.
I did keep asking you, when does he begin killering? you have to wait for it.
So he gets involved with this this French prostitute, and I forget the actress's name, but the two of them, the two actors and the director, all co-wrote the film. And, you know, it's basically just a thing of things just spiral and get more and more uncomfortable, and he gets weirder and weirder, and you know that things are building to a head, and it's just, you know, it's this sort of grimy, you know, circling down the drain where you're hoping that at the bottom of the drain there's going to be some reason of why you went down there, and there kind of isn't, was my problem with the movie. It's really just sort of a, well, this guy's a jerk. The end.
Well, he's more than a jerk.
No, he's psychotic.
Dangerous.
Yeah. I will say that it's another terrific Brady Corbett performance. This is an actor I've really liked ever since Mysterious Skin. Yeah. I have still not seen the live-action Thunderbirds movie that he was in as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he'd rather I didn't. But, you know, this is a guy who, you know, handsome young actor, could have very easily been on, like, Gossip Girl or whatever. Right. And, you know, instead has been, you know, he was in Melancholia. He was in the U.S. remake of Funny Games. He was in Mysterious Skin. You know, clearly drawn to edgier directors, more difficult material. So I'm a fan.
He has explicitly stated this.
Oh, really? I've never read an interview.
Yeah, I just, while you were watching the movie,
you Googled him.
I Googled him. I was like looking at a little interview where he said, you know, I want to work. He actually said, this is a paraphrase of the quote, but he said, I care about film history.
Oh.
And I want to be a part of it.
Oh, cool.
And I want to be in movies that will be a part of it. And so,
Like, he's not even doing one for me, one for them. Like, no. They're literally all one for me is this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, yeah good on him. I wish I liked the movie more, but I like him in it a lot. I think he's fascinating to watch even when he should, by rights, become unwatchable because the character is so unappealing.
Well, here's how he can play super unappealing and stay watchable because he's cute.
I guess,
like,
yeah.
That's your secret weapon.
He's working with what he's got.
Your secret weapon is, you know, I'm so attractive that I can be this downward spiral.
And in this movie, I mean, he's kind of grungy.
Ryan Gosling does the same thing.
True. I mean, he's kind of grungy and unshaven, so he's not, like, glamming it up or anything. But at the same time, he's not doing that, like, Jared Leto, how ugly can I make myself? Stop looking at me!
Yeah.
You know, thing.
Right.
So, yeah, he strikes a good balance, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, I saw the ending, so I never have to watch this movie.
But my DVD pick is After School, which was Campos' debut film as a writer-director. And I thought it was really powerful and disturbing, and I wish more people had seen it. I remember I put it on my top 10 list that year in a tie with Cloverfield.
How do you remember these things? How do you remember what your top 10 list was and what tied?
I couldn't.
For any given year.
Well, okay. I couldn't tell you the entire list necessarily. I just remember if a movie was or wasn't on there. I remember that.
How do you remember that?
I remember that it tied, if you'll let me finish.
I'm going to have to, I guess.
Both films, I thought, were about how young people see the world through the camera and through the internet and through YouTube and through, you know, their, you know, phones or whatever. Like, it's all about the technology, and it's about how it brings things closer, but it also puts things at a distance. And I thought in After School, it's, you know, a really interesting movie about these, like, young students, one of whom is played by Ezra Miller, who, it's funny, because I would see him, and I think, I've seen that guy before, you know, like, even in the early stuff before, like, you know, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and now I realize it's because he was in After School.
Right.
Get so, like, desensitized to sex and violence from the stuff they watch on the internet that when it actually happens in front of them in real life, they have no idea how to do anything but just look at it or treat it as this abstract thing.
Take a little video of it.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So it's a very disturbing film, but I think very powerful, and I liked it a lot. And if you have not seen it, which it didn't get a huge release, you probably missed it.
Yeah, I didn't
check
see
it out. After School.
I still don't understand how you remember things from your top 10 list. The years that someone will like make me write a top 10 list for publication,
right?
I do it. I don't remember anything about it after.
Okay, I've done but it. You have to remember, I was writing top 10 lists back when nobody asked me to.
So your annual top 10 list is very important to you.
I mean, again, I don't remember what year that even was. Like, it was 2007, 2008, whatever year Cloverfield came out.
Yeah.
And I would be hard-pressed to tell you that entire list in order. But, like, if a movie that was on that list comes up in conversation, I will remember, oh, yeah, that was one of my top 10 films that year, whatever year that was.
All right.
So I'm not crazy about it.
I think you're crazy.
I know. I'm just more on it than you are. It's of less interest and import to you.
I experienced the world, and then a minute later, I don't remember the experience I just had.
Your goldfish memory. Okay, speaking of things we don't remember, Chil Kong letter.
I got it. Hi, Alonzo and Dave. I've been meaning to send this list to you since the beginning of the best list. I don't even know what that means. Mostly because I've noticed...
Since when we started asking for
people. Y'all would occasionally mention Asian movies, but only occasionally.
never enough. Never enough for Mr. and Mrs. Chil Kong.
I'm setting my little list so y'all can share the wealth of Asian cinema that's out there. I tried to keep it to 10. I fudged and said 11. I could have easily made a top 10 list from each of the Pacific Rim countries.
Your guide to Laotian cinema from Chil Kong.
It's funny, he goes, though I haven't seen a lot from a lot of Laotian, Indonesian, or films from Guam, I also didn't include any documentaries, because that's its own list.
Mm.
Here they are.
Okay.
Seven Samurai.
Sure.
Or any Kurosawa.
Well, that's like saying they're all equivalent, which, okay, whatever.
He says most any movie by Akira Kurosawa.
Fair enough.
Old Boy.
Okay.
I can't pronounce this movie. Taegukgi? I've never heard of this.
Okay, me neither.
Yeah, it's one of the best war movies ever done and explains why there will never be a united Korea. we have to look up the trailer for this and post it on the...
Okay, definitely.
Because I don't know. I don't know this film.
Me neither.
Raise the Red Lantern?
Oh, love it.
He says, this is my introduction to Asian cinema and to the breathtaking Gong Li.
Hmm.
Enter the Dragon. Yes. He says, I know this isn't technically Asian cinema, but it changed my life. And because of it, everyone I meet thinks I do martial arts. I do, but that's beside the point. I've never seen him martial arts.
Me neither. I will take his word for it.
I need a demonstration.
I've never seen him solve complex math equations or play the violin either. But if he told me he could, I would believe it.
Spirited Away.
Ah, yes.
I could have done an entire segment on anime, but when push comes to shove, I'd pick this one each time. Akira and Ghost in the Shell are among my other favorites.
Sure.
The Wedding Banquet.
Yeah, okay.
Because he's gay. So gay. He's so gay, he married Aaron Quill. That's how gay that dude is.
Yeah, I thought Robert Abeley was going to be the gayest straight man in my life.
The most...
And then Chil Kong came along.
Gay heterosexual man on the planet. Like, yeah. If there was a contest of who's gayer, you or Chil Kong.
Without actually being gay.
He would be at the top of the mountain just kicking everyone off the mountain.
Yes.
Yeah.
What are those kicks called? Like the choreography ones, like circle kicks or something?
The gay kick.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. He would gay kick you.
One liner I blew because I don't know the terminology.
He would gay kick you off the mountain. Kung Fu Hustle, which is a blast. Like, if The Raid Redemption were a comedy, it'd be Kung Fu Hustle.
There you go.
Tampopo, just fantastic movie.
A movie that needs desperately to be released on DVD. It was out for like 2 seconds, and it was sort of a crappy VHS transfer. That's a movie that has just disappeared from the radar, and so people need to see it because it's so funny. And especially now... Because there's so much food in the culture all the cooking stuff.
Exactly.
People would love that movie.
My Sassy Girl, I've never seen it.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it either.
It's a famous Korean movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Farewell, My Concubine. That's his number 11. He writes, lovely, lovely movie, broke my heart. Cause you're gay.
Leslie Cheung is in that movie. That's all I'll say.
I love listening and looking forward to more. And thank you for all the many shout-outs. I know. I think we talk about Chill more than anyone.
Could be.
We discuss the life and times of Chill Kong more than anyone
well,
we know.
Well, because he is father of most adorable baby.
He is father of
who the is most, not related to me.
He is the father of the most adorable baby in the world. He says, thank you for all the many shout-outs, and I'm sure it was Aaron's fault that I wasn't cast in Olympus. We knew that from the get-go.
Absolutely.
She's a tough one. She's mean and yells at people. So,
and she writes a very controversial blog. So look out.
While we're on the subject of idiosyncratic top 10 lists,
yes.
Here's a letter from Matt, who sent us his top 10 list of his favorite Daniel Day-Lewis performances.
Okay.
Here they are. Cecil in A Room with a View.
Sure.
Jack Slavin or Slavin in The Ballad of Jack and Rose.
Okay.
Jerry Conlon in The Name of the Father. Ugh. Hawkeye in The Last of the Mohicans. Mm.
I'm not objecting to Daniel Day-Lewis in these movies. I don't like these movies. You like these movies.
The Last of the Mohicans is great.
I've never gotten
the Michael Mann.
Look, I love me some I'm sorry. I'm not a fan of them.
William Cutting in Gangs of New York. Newland Archer in The Age of Innocence.
Yes.
John Proctor in The Crucible.
Sure.
Christy Brown in My Left Foot.
Yeah.
Abraham Lincoln in Lincoln.
Yes.
And There Will Be Blood.
Okay.
All your Daniel Day-Lewis's are 100% knife.
My Beautiful Laundrette did not make the list?
No. Look, it's a subjective list. This is personal favorites. I don't think that there's a system of weights and measures that come with this.
Well, but clearly he has weighted and measured the Daniel Day-Lewis filmography and found these to be the top 10. So My Beautiful Laundrette did not make the cut.
All right, you get 90% knife for leaving off.
I mean, good on you for not including Stars and Bars and Ever Smile New Jersey, but still, you know.
I ate a
lot. Last of the Mohicans does have Madeline Stowe in it, so there's that. Yes. But otherwise, I'm not into it. I'm sorry.
In other listener news, I ate lunch with a listener yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Travis.
Yes.
Travis Moose. Remember I said...
Oh, right. I hope Moose is your real name, yes.
He and his partner came to town, and I took him to Irv's.
Nice.
Right around the corner from our house.
I would have loved to have gone, but
it's because I'm lazy. It helps that Irv's is the greatest place in the world.
Around the corner, yes.
But it also helps that I'm super lazy and never want to travel to do anything. So, like, I was like, come on over, we'll go to Irv's. And they loved it.
Good, good. No, I would have gone. I was chained to the sofa all day. So.
Yeah, yeah. Not by me.
No, by work.
You're doing work.
Work obligations.
Yeah. And one more letter.
Yes.
This is from Ryan. We've been sitting on this one for a little while.
Okay.
It's about Spring Breakers.
Oh, okay.
I saw Spring Breakers, and if that movie isn't racist, then it comes darn close to it. Selena Gomez's character is obviously racist. She has no problem drinking, doing drugs, aiding and abetting felons when they're white people. But the moment she enters a pool hall full of black people, she starts freaking out and saying things like, I didn't sign up for this. Mm-hmm. Second, the lighter side of the film is 95% filled with white people partying on beaches and hotel rooms. The darker side of the film comes into play when black people are introduced. The only black people with speaking lines in the film are thugs and criminals. Finally, in regards to gun violence, when Rachel Corrine is shot in the arm, the film portrays it as a jarring event. However, at the end of the film, when a group of black people are murdered, the film doesn't have equal sympathy, understanding, and value for them. Vanessa Hudgens and Ashley Benson receive no visible consequences for the robberies and murders they commit. Please read and discuss.
Well, those are all valid points.
Wait, there's more.
Oh.
P.S. I enjoy your show. Dave is very funny.
That's nice.
That's right.
You're hilarious. Those are valid points, certainly. I would argue that in the case of Rachel Corrine getting shot and it being a big deal, it's because that's who the movie's about.
The POV of the film is these four white girls.
Yeah. You know, and I think that, you know...
Or, well, Hudgens and Gomez.
Right, yeah.
Latino.
I think that, you know, I think any movie you have you know, the people the movie are about, it's more about their pain and triumph or whatever. And you're, I mean, granted, you know, the bad guys in this movie, as such as they are, do happen to all be black.
I have I have thoughts on that.
What do you got?
Well, they are the people that Franco wants to be.
True, he's emulating them. They
Franco
are
Franco wants role to models. Be. Yeah. Franco's character wishes he were a black criminal.
Right.
And therefore, those are the folks he associates with. You would probably not see him associating with another white guy who wants to be black, because then it would be a competition.
Right.
And so, it is, the film is from the perspective of these white folks. Mm-hmm. That's correct. But I think, and I'm holding to this, that having racist characters is not the same thing as the film being racist.
Right. I don't think the movie endorses... And the film he's right about Selena Gomez, but I don't think the film is endorsing her point of view.
Yeah. The film understands that these people are...
Sheltered and stupid.
Are coming from their own idiot worlds.
Right.
And that's... I mean, to me, that's clear. I don't, you know... I don't believe it's a racist film. I believe it is a film that includes racism... as a plot point.
Yeah.
More than once.
And I think you could make a point. I mean, the film is really, I think, a very sort of damning critique about media images that young people are fed and how that leads to what they think of is appropriate behavior or aspirational or whatever. And I think that part of what the film is going after is the sort of exoticization of African Americans.
Exoticization.
Yeah.
That's a form of that word?
That's a word.
All right.
The exoticization of
I'm going to look that up.
It's a little grad school, but it is a word, I promise.
I'm going to, yeah.
You know, that you get from, like, MTV and stuff. I mean, because, like you said, Franco's character wants to be a black criminal. You know, he behaves as though he were on his own episode of Cribs.
Right.
You know, and so I think the movie is... If the movie is indulging in that, it's doing it with a critical eye. I'm going to say I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt on that, but I can see, but not so much that I don't think that other readings are valid.
Right. One thing that surprised me, the scenes of partying,
mm-hmm.
there is very, very specifically a loop of topless girls.
Right. And there's one
black girl. And I will say that actually that sort of surprised me. Because often the images of spring break that you are given by the media, you don't see any black
people. Entirely white. Yeah, that's true. No, white. I was going to ask, because I mean...
And so I'm wondering if that's good or bad that we see this one black girl
It's the one black friend syndrome, you know, which people have talked about, where like you've got the sitcoms or the people in a commercial and there's always the one black friend, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's more honest or less honest than just not having any, because, I mean, I'm wondering how integrated actual spring break is. I mean...
I don't know.
Because, I mean,
I've never participated in that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Mardi Gras, but I never went to Florida. I mean, because there's Freaknik, right? Isn't that the thing in Atlanta that people go to? That's like the black spring break, basically.
I don't know. You're from Atlanta. You should know.
That all happened after I left. I think it does raise interesting questions. And I'm glad that we got a letter to, you know, because the discussion is part of this movie. I think it doesn't answer everything, and it doesn't necessarily always speak for itself. You have to kind of figure out where it's leading you and what it has to say about that.
Yes. Yes, it does. Bill from Vegas writes, "Hey, guys, this might be long, but I thought of it when Dave mentioned that Viva L'Amour was on YouTube. An app I've been using the hell out of on my iPad or any iOS or Android platform is called Twonky Beam.
Do love that movie, The Twonky.
It's probably the best way to put YouTube on your TV. Now, you do have to have a streaming device on your TV like a Roku box. It works with my Sony Blu-ray player that has the YouTube app, also works with AT&T.
You have no idea what any of this
means. Xbox, stuff like that. The biggest problem with these YouTube apps on TV devices is that you're stuck using a Blu-ray remote control to try to input searches or put in your YouTube credentials to log in and get your flagged or saved favorites. This will let you use a more realistic keyboard on your phone or tablet. Then you just hit the beam button, it overlays on the video, and it basically makes your device go get what you want. My iPad is already logged into YouTube. I can go through my subscriptions and watch them. If the video on YouTube is in HD, it will be in HD on your TV. It will also take music and video from any devices you have on your Wi-Fi network. My computer, my storage drive full of concerts, etc. One of the things I've been toying with is consulting with people on how to get off of cable TV. I'm fairly well versed in cable alternatives, and this app has really been great. Of course, it requires that people have a smart device, but I'm pretty sure that number will surpass cable subscriptions if they haven't already. As I said, you don't have to read this on the internet. I just did. But if you recommend other movies in the future where YouTube is likely the easiest way to access, this might be a good topic to bring up. Cheers, Bill in Vegas. I have no idea what I just read.
Neither do I, to be honest. But someone will.
Thank you, Bill in Vegas. You are from another planet.
This is what we have.
That I don't know the language
of. This is what we have the other Daves for.
Well, Dave Cobb.
Dave Cobb and Dave Kittredge understand that stuff.
Yeah, I never understand anything Kittredge is saying either.
Yeah.
Ever. The minute he starts talking that nerd-ish.
When he starts telling you the difference between the Sony Red and the new Canon, blah, I'm like, blah, 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 blah. Ginger, yeah. Yeah. No idea.
Nothing makes sense. The end. End of all the letters. That was my favorite one. I feel like it's something to aspire to. Like, I aspire to understand that letter.
What is it? Twonky Beam?
Twonky Beam.
Twonky Beam. Okay. As always, we thank you for listening, and we urge you to check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast. By the way, guys, thank you for your very kind shout-out to my Werner Herzog impersonation. It made me very happy to hear about it. Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program for free. Free! At iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review, that would be nifty. You can stream this show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Please like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can follow me at A Duraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E, or follow Dave at D Leland White, all one word. You can check into the show at getglue.com, and please drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your top 10 lists, questions, recommendations, anything else. We love hearing from you. So, yeah, I guess we will catch you next time.
Done. Goodbye.